episode 7 of Out the HUD podcast. I'm James De Los Santos, and today I'm very excited. I have a friend here, if I can call her a friend. She's a mother, a world traveler, and a journalist, and she just published one of her newest books called Black American Refugee, Tiffany Drayton.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm just going to, of course, state the subtitle as well because I'm ridiculous. Escaping the Narcissism of the American Dream is the subtitle.
Definitely. Yeah, I see they're written in a smaller font. So, So please, I think the first thing we get into is tell me how, you know, I wouldn't say you're from Hudson County, even though you do have a big portion of your life from North Bergen, but from the book itself, it seems that you're from around the world. You consider yourself a person, a part of the world.
Oh, absolutely. I'm, you know, second to my identity as a mother is being a world traveler because I'm really just a woman of the world. I've just always loved traveling and seeing as much as I can. And however, fundamentally, yeah, I'm a North Bergen girl. I was raised in North Bergen. I spent like a lot of my formative years here. So it's really great to be back and be able to speak with you.
Yeah, and I'm excited. I'm super proud because, you know, we're classmates. So to see someone like you, and I know that being in this writing is not an easy job. So to break through all the minutiae and actually get all the noise and actually have your book recognized, super exciting for you.
Yeah.
And one of the first things in the book, which I'm going to open the book now so if you hear the pages flipping, is the way you describe North Bergen. And I'm going to read it out. And I think, you know, it's a great thing for us to speak about because I'm from here. And for you to write it, it's just you brought me to another place. I recognize that place, but it's I wouldn't be able to describe North Bergen the same elegance you did.
Okay.
So it says here, my mom had managed to secure a one-bedroom apartment for us in North Bergen, New Jersey, a tiny, bustling, hilly immigrant town right across the Hudson River, directly opposite of New York City. The town was run by Italians, and my memories of it are like a canvas painted in watercolor. The vivid splashes of every color representing the diverse faces of my neighborhood and friends. There were Hispanics, whites, Middle Eastern, and many East Asian first generation families. And there, my tiny black family blended right in.
Absolutely.
And I thought that was so beautiful to hear.
Well, it was absolutely true. You know, I came to North Bergen with my mom back in the 90s. It was the first town that I ever lived in after immigrating from Trinidad and Tobago as a child. So, you know, my first memories were really just bouncing up and down North Bergen, Bergen Line with my mom and shopping and getting in and out of the buses and just always hearing bachata, merengue, you know. And it's just one of those towns that made you feel so welcome even if you weren't necessarily from the culture, because the culture was just so like expansive and explosive that of course there was like space for you to enjoy it too.
Definitely. Now, when moving from Trinidad and Tobago to North Bergen, what was the biggest difference for you as far as was it a cultural difference? Was it just the way the towns were laid out? Like,
no, I mean, there was no difference for me because I guess I was so young that there was no comparison. North Bergen is where I was raised. It's where I have my first memories, really. Coming to America is, I would say, one of my first memories ever. And just seeing, like, the skyline and everything lit up, that has really stayed with me over the years. Prior to that, I really just didn't remember anything. And that kind of informed my identity, you know, seeing myself as an American foremost. I never really saw myself as an immigrant because I didn't remember home. North Bergen was home.
Definitely. So now the book is called Black American Refugee.
Mm-hmm.
So those titles obviously are kind of conflicting. So kind of get me through how you came up with the title and what it means to you.
Oh, well.
The title without the subtitle. I don't want to miss out on the subtitle.
Yeah, I'm very, very serious about my subtitles. Subtitles are important. So Black American Refugee was pretty much born of that constant struggle and the need to escape it, right? You know, being a black woman in America, despite the fact that my early experiences with the country were so beautiful and embracing in North Bergen, like eventually just watching like the price for housing skyrocket, just gentrification, just every single thing that I experienced from that early childhood moment on to up until I was a woman, you know, in my early adulthood. It was just really rife with so much struggle that at some point I was, you know, living in Jersey City, living in the hood, gunshots every day, people on drugs, depressed, in an abusive relationship, and just with no real means, despite attending college, despite always working so hard, like no real means to change my circumstances except for escape. And that's where the idea of being a refugee comes in, because I feel like if had I not left and had I not taken my family with me at that time, we would have faced so much hardship that it could have even been life-altering or life-claiming.
Understood. Now, I see that it seems like you and your brother had like a similar type of moment in life where she saw a moment that she needed to take you out of Trinidad to bring you here for a better life. Mm-hmm. And you seem to have had the opposite, where you needed to bring your family outside of America.
Yeah.
So tell me kind of like that kind of conflicting thing where your mother brought you here for one reason, but you're feeling the need to go back.
Yeah, you know, it's so sad. But as we see right now, even with the situation in Ukraine, as refugees are literally fleeing war, you still see a distinct difference between the way that Black refugees are treated versus the way that white refugees are treated. So it's like it really forces you to reckon with the reality that Black people needing to move and constantly run and escape and hardship always being on their tails, you don't know where that will drive you. And you see, for my mom, trying to escape that constantness of hardship meant that she wanted to bring her kids to the United States of America. But it's like for me, after living through the experiences of being a Black woman and a Black child in America, experiences that she would have never been exposed to, I had to reckon with, well, maybe that's not the answer. And the truth is, for me, that definitely was not the answer.
Yeah. And I see that you, when you said you and your brother had a vision of America as being a meritocracy,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, you worked hard.
Yeah.
Do you still feel that way?
Oh, absolutely not. And I mean, if anybody feels that way, I'm not sure how. They must not be paying attention to the news at all. As we see with one of the most profound instances of how we have been bamboozled would be that student loan debt crisis. It's like so many people fought so hard to be able to go to college and to be able to further their education in the hopes that in return they would have access to a better paying job and be able to afford life. And instead we've been buried in debt.
Understood. You know,
and that debt is disproportionately shouldered by Black women and by people of color. And that screams reality, which conflicts with this fictionality and with this delusion and illusion of meritocracy.
Definitely. And I know you said that the book itself is a plea for reparations.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we could kind of tie it into that, an exploding debt crisis on student loans, disproportionate at brown people and Black people.
Yep.
So tell me how this kind of book ties that idea in.
Right. That's why I kept telling you about the subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
So the subtitle, Escaping the Narcissism of the American Dream, speaks to the cycle of narcissistic abuse that I wanted to capture by telling my story. Because more than just a story about racism, this story is also a story about escaping abuse and about what it means to come to terms with being in an abusive relationship. And for myself as a woman, as a mother of two, I found myself in an abusive relationship some years ago, and it forced me to really face what that meant. And abuse is a cycle, right? I kind of demonstrate that cycle throughout the chapters of the book, where you have love bombing, where you're told, oh, you're made for me, you know, God put us together, everything is going to be perfect, and you're sold this perfect fairy tale. And then eventually the abuser moves into the phase of like devaluing you, where they take control of your narrative. And there's so many examples of that for me on an interpersonal level in my relationship with a narcissistic type of partner, as well as my relationship with the United States of America. So kind of as I was breaking myself free of that abusive relationship, it really forced me to also look at my relationship to the country itself, to the United States of America. And I saw so many similarities. And ultimately, at the end of that road, right, of escaping and breaking free from narcissistic abuse is, in my opinion, reconciliation, if there is to be the continuation of a relationship. Like, if I am to continue to live in the United States of America as a Black woman, am I not entitled to freedom? Am I not entitled to no longer live under the weight of constant abuse? And similarly, it's like, if I am to continue a relationship with my ex that's a healthy one, should he not be accountable for his behavior? Should he not afford me with closure and, you know, reconciliation. So that's why the conversation about reconciliation is so important. And I call reparations reconciliatory justice because ultimately that's what it is. It's pushing for the reconciliation of Black people's relationship with this country that has dealt constant abuses and degradation and demanding justice.
Definitely. Now, how do you see this rollout? Is reparations through money? Is it through programs? How does that look in your mind?
You know, as we watch the United States of America start the printing press and we're the printing press with one point how much ever trillion or I don't even know at this point. I mean, I feel like we're going to have a new way to count money. We're going to go beyond quadrillion any minute now because we are in crisis. And thus, for me, I would never even begin to put a price tag on what reparations or reconciliatory justice would look like. This is ultimately, for me, primarily accountability, right? Mm-hmm. You need to be able to say, look, listen, this happened. It was wrong. Write that into law. I don't know how, still to this day, there is no acknowledgement of the hideousness of racism at a federal level. Yeah, you might have some lip service from some company that wants to sell Black Lives Matter t-shirts in Target or whatever the hell, but that is not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is true acknowledgement at the federal level from governments, and that's on one side. On the other side, you have to ultimately provide the resources to help communities of color move into the future. And what I'm really grateful for is, despite the fact that this is like a hard moment, it's also like a transformative moment. Because as we watch so many elements of our society crumble, so many institutions are crumbling, like so many things are failing, like money-wise, I feel like everybody's in debt.
Yeah. Right now with the inflation as well.
And,
you know?
And with inflation, it's like, it's like, where, what is this? Yeah. When is this going to end? How high can this go,
right? I just went to Target, spent $200. I think I have a bottle of water. And
yeah, for real. Maybe a loaf of bread. Yeah. So watching these realities unfold, we must then question, well, how do we meet the moment? How do we transition, for example, into renewables and clean energy? How do we make sure that people have access to healthcare and proper education? We're at a moment that demands the action and the involvement of everyone. There's not a single person that should not be active on some level, whether it be canceling debt, student loan debt, credit card debt, you name it, whether it be pushing for renewables, whether it be pushing for healthcare. All of these things are a big part of what reconciliatory justice means, and specifying ways that we can address these needs within communities of color, within Native American communities, within Black American communities, within Black communities in general, all oppressed communities, is essential, certainly. But what I will say is this is a moment that demands all Americans be involved in transitioning and rolling over our society into a more equitable one, into a cleaner one, et cetera.
Definitely. Now, one thing I'd like to, or I guess, get your opinion on is North Bergen, North Hudson County, primarily, like you wrote, a Spanish, a Hispanic oasis, which I think is the perfect definition of Bergeline.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now, you know, publicly, I've been involved in racial justice marches and demonstrations. So I have, you know, a little bit of experience in this. And one thing that I've run into a lot around here, and I think you could help me, I think me and you might be on the same level as this, is everyone, anytime we talked about bringing up Black education, Black reparations, any Black justice, I always got pushback. Well, what about Spanish people? What about Puerto Ricans? What about et cetera? Mm-hmm. And my feeling, to give you my opinion, and maybe you could work within that, is that if you break down the barriers of what Black people have gone through in this country, everyone after that is going to be okay, just like happened in the civil rights era, where we got a massive immigration flow after that.
Precisely.
So do you run into that at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what you're describing, you know, is something that I have been really, I've been really steadfast in preaching. Like, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And what people don't realize is the United States of America has used Black Americans, and specifically Black people and who their ancestors came here, who are descendants of slaves that came to America on boats, right? They have used this population of people as a juxtaposition for whiteness to allow for the dehumanization and for the ghettoization and to really take away and strip away the rights of humans. And the truth is, if it's okay for any group, it will eventually become okay for you. And that's the thing that people, especially immigrants of varying hues, right? They're like, well, that's not my struggle. I'm not black. You may not be black today, but you'll be black tomorrow once there's a squeeze on the economic circumstances in this country. And there are so many examples of that. And we will see them more and more and more. So what I will say is I try my best to be forward focused. Why? Well, because the truth is, if I were to tell you that I wrote this book 5 years ago, it would have never gotten published at that time, right? This book is the end result of an explosive moment, that 2020 murder of George Floyd and the protest that resulted. And I'm grateful for those moments where we as Americans decide, listen, no, that's not okay, that's not appropriate. It doesn't matter if you're black, if you're white, if you're any color, it's not appropriate for anyone. And those moments will become more, there will be more of those moments as time progresses and as the struggles that will become no longer just black struggles, they're going to become universal struggles. And we're seeing it already. We're seeing it every day. As you said, you went to Target, you got yourself a nice loaf of bread and a bottle of water.
And it was a half a loaf of bread. They sell half loaves. I didn't know they
right,
did that.
Right. I didn't even know they had half loaves. Now they have half loaves. So we will recognize, whether forcefully or, you know, whether you intellectually read a book and read some history and understand that the plight of black people in this country is the plight of all minority people, whether you do that or whether you're forced into the blackened circumstances of being a part of the underclass that can't afford a loaf of bread because somebody, some white middle-aged rich guy decided in Congress to say you no longer are afforded whatever it is that's helping you get by with your family or whatever has helped you to provide for your family or the student loans, like when they put off student loans for a couple of years mm-hmm. due to the pandemic, right? If there were a few more people who looked like us, maybe they would put it off for a few more years or maybe they would cancel
just
it altogether.
Cancel it all together, yeah.
Right. So it's like once we recognize that this is not a fight of a single demographic anymore, this is a universal struggle because I'm going to repeat it. What's good for the goose is good for the gander, and that's that.
Now, I spoke with one of your friends. I'm not going to say his name because maybe he doesn't want to be on the podcast. But he said that he spoke with you a lot about racial issues versus class issues. And he mm-hmm. believes it's more of a class issue.
Mm.
I'm with you on it's a race issue because I know people of color on the higher economic scale who still have to go through the struggles of racism.
Right.
So class does play a piece as far as, you know, poor people are poor and you're going to get treated a certain way. But even when you break out of that economic status as someone of color, you still have to deal with those struggles.
Right, precisely.
And I'm sure, like we were talking about even before the podcast, that there's a lot of things going on around that involve non-people. White people,
White folk.
So yeah, so tell me, how do you navigate through that now? Knowing you're a professional, I wrote it down here. You wrote in the New York Times, Vox, Playboy, and Complex.
Mm-hmm.
Those are just to name a few. You know, mm-hmm. just to name some of the ones that I knew my audience would know.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, how do you navigate through that world?
You know, this argument of is it class, is it race, is really it's dumb. Because quite frankly, it is a structure and it is the systematic oppression of a group juxtaposed against propping up another group, which is this group of whiteness, which is this ever elusive, ever changing group, which began with WASPs, right? You couldn't be white in America in the beginning days if you were Irish, if you were Italian, right? These people were treated as not white, just so we're clear. White, that group of privileged whites was safeguarded for WASPs. And as more people immigrated into the country from Italy, and simultaneously you had immigrants from all over the world, these groups were put on a socioeconomic, political, and social ladder, as so to speak. Like it's a system. It's mm-hmm. a full system. And while it may be true that they have kept black people, especially descendants of
of chattel slavery at the bottom rungs of that structure, that ultimately the point here is that you cannot take, like, you cannot separate race from class, because in the United States of America, the whole system of class is based on race. So they are intricately interconnected. And while you may be poor and white, just dust off your shirt, go buy a new one, and you can walk into the golf club if you're a man. I can't say the same. I could be a millionaire, and if I walk into that same golf club as a black woman, I am not going to get treated the same. So that's just a fact of life, and that's something you pointed out earlier as well.
Definitely. I wanted to get into your experience in, obviously, the podcast called Out the HUD. I wanted to get into your experiences in North Bergen or Hudson County. Doesn't mm-hmm, have to actually mm-hmm. be the walls of 07047. But what did you take from the experiences here that maybe other places don't afford that same experience?
Oh, I mean, North Bergen is a very unique town. Mm-hmm. I would say beginning with the good, mm-hmm. which is the sense of like community and neighborhood, right? I remember being a kid and I was running around North Bergen everywhere. Like, I lived on 61st mm-hmm. and I would walk to Lincoln School and with my brother from the time we were maybe 5 years old. And we would literally walk from the bottom of the hill, like in between Tunnelly and like Kennedy, like, but towards Tunnelly, all the way to Lincoln School, which is a pretty far walk.
Yeah, it's a walk.
Like,
especially for a five-year-old.
Especially
now,
for like a five-year-old.
Five-year-olds can't walk away now.
Now they can barely leave their living room playing whatever game they're playing. You know, it's like, oh. So it's like that type of upbringing where we were safe enough to do that. And, you know, I remember summer times with like the North Bergen police on their bikes and the shorts. it was just like this really hometowny feel, which was really beautiful for us.
Yeah, we got to go out for lunch.
Imagine
a group of 400 eight-year-olds running out.
I know. It's so crazy that I can't even imagine the childhood that I had existing right mm-hmm. now. But what I will say is the childhood that I had didn't actually exist elsewhere. And that's something that I realized too, like once I left North Bergen, because I lived in North Bergen between like 4 to 8 the first time.
Okay.
And then my family moved to Texas. And it's like
in the book, yeah.
Right. It's in the book.
Amazon.com.
Right. And it's like when we moved to Texas, I was like, wait a minute, we can't go outside for lunch? Wait a minute. It's like the school has no windows. Wait a minute. I don't know all the kids' names in my classes. Like, I felt like, where's home? Like, I felt so out of place. And that's something that I realized was like specific to North Bergen. It's mm-hmm. not like a America thing. Maybe it's like an America small town thing. I don't know. But it's I realized instantaneously. And even visiting my cousins in Edison, you know, because I had some cousins who lived out in Edison, and I remember we would go visit them. And my aunt was always like, oh my God, you're too loud. Or, you know, like, you need to be quiet, you know? Or like when we were in the park, if we were running and screaming, she would like come over to the park and be like, you can't run and scream. It's like, well, what the hell can you do here, you know? So...
Yeah, no, in the book you say her neighborhood, you didn't even know people were her neighbors or not. No. You weren't sure, they were never outside.
You'd never see anyone. And it was just so like the exact opposite of what I was raised with. Because mm-hmm. I lived on a block where everybody knew us kids. And whether they thought we were the most annoying, like ridiculous kids, or, you know, they thought that we were sweet kids, they still knew us. They said hi to us. They knew our parents. And so we got that real old school upbringing, you mm-hmm. know, like come home before the sun goes down kind of upbringing, where your kids disappear in the morning and come back.
I think we might be the last generation.
I think so, which is sad. And that's like one of those things that North Bergen really gave me, just a sense of freedom as a child, which also like brings along a sense of responsibility.
Yes, it does.
Because it's like now I see kids, I'm like, these kids, I wouldn't trust them to cross the street. You know, I really wouldn't. Like a lot of 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, it's like, I wouldn't trust them to go to the store and get something. So it's really a change of the times. And so like North Bergen in the beginning was just like that home base. But it's like, there are other things that you begin to realize as you get older too, right? And a lot of it has to do with like the school system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, living in Texas, as much as it's not home-like, you have so much access to resources because the schools, like the buildings are new. I mean, everything is new, really.
Yeah. And so, here we started in 1900s.
Yeah. You know? Here when you walk in the building, it's like, 1764. You know, like, it's like, was the country even founded yet? Like,
everything's wood.
You know, like, everything's
like, I've never seen a wooden blackboard. It's weird.
I know. And it was especially bad because at some point my family actually had relocated to Florida. And I went to this ridiculously like rich white kid school, mostly white, and they would bus in like kids of color like me. And being in that school, I was like so spoiled. And I didn't know I was getting spoiled. You know, I didn't know that all schools didn't have like nice projectors and whiteboards and, you know, dry erase boards and didn't have a big like courtyard in the middle. And it didn't have like film production classes where you could like make a film in the class. We had like a full film production class where we created a whole crew. We had actors, we had, you know, and this is in high school. It had like a morning TV show that like the kids would record.
I watched like a TV show that had one of those, I was like, now you see why I created Hot Post, but I was like, I want to do the news for the high school.
I know, it was just such a like awesome experience. But that's another place my family got priced out of because we couldn't afford to live there. So eventually we ended up moving back to North Bergen. I would say in my teen years when I was like 15, and immediately, as soon as I walked into like North Bergen High School, I was like, what is this? Why? You know, and I went home, I was like, I can't do this. You know, I was just like complaining to my mom every single day because my understanding of what was the norm had shifted so drastically. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is not it, you know, this is hood. And the worst part really wasn't just the school and what appeared to be like the fact that the building was old or, you know, those kinds of things. It was really the attitude that a lot of the teachers had towards the students, because you quickly realize like the students and the teachers aren't from the same culture. They don't share their same hue. And the students, to a large extent, were treated like disposable. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, these kids can't learn anything. These kids aren't that smart. These kids aren't that or this. And for me, having so many Hispanic friends who, firstly, my best friend, Carla, you know, she came from Ecuador when she was like 11 or 12. And I met her maybe when she was 14. And she spoke the most perfect English. I would have never imagined that she did not know English before she immigrated. It was impossible for me to imagine. And that really spoke to how hard people work to come to this country and to even begin to assimilate. Like, just knowing that a child has done that should give you so much respect for that child. But when you're in an environment where perhaps your teacher doesn't even understand any part of that struggle, they just see you and compare you to what they think should be the norm, right? Definitely. Which is probably like English as a first language or whatever. And so all of a sudden it's like, instead of this is a hardworking student that has to also deal with learning another language, it's like this is a lazy student who can't even speak English properly. You know, so it's like the narratives that were created around the student body. It was really hurtful to have to watch that because I think it's called self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, it's like if you say something about a group of people, well, yeah, you're going to make it come true. And I was witnessing that a lot.
Yeah, and I felt that way too, because I always felt, I think they call the class ESL. Mm-hmm. I always felt they had them off to the side and never, what do we call it, like,
assimilated, incorporated,
yeah,
right?
Exactly, yeah. And then you find out years later, you're like, wow, these, you know, I can't believe I've never had the experience of being friends with one of those, you know.
It's sad. Yeah. It's sad because isn't that's supposed to be like the dream that people are invested in as educators, that anyone can walk into your class and leave feeling more powerful and empowered, right? And better educated. Like, but when you're in a school environment where, for example, I remember I had a history teacher who would literally come in and be like, and this was a history class that was actually an honors class.
Okay.
And the teacher would come in and literally read off the answers to the test the day before the test. And it's like, I was so upset. I'm always outraged, just so we're clear. You know, and especially because, you know, I came from a school where...
By the way, when we walked in, she was outraged about the weather. She said, I can't believe you picked this day out of all days.
It's like the only rainy, snowy day for like the past week. It's been like perfect weather for the week. And then you picked this day. But it was my fault. I actually rescheduled. But yeah, I was outraged. But it's like... experiencing that sense of like constant outrage in the school environment because these teachers just really wanted as easy of a way out as possible, with the exception of the few who really made a big difference. And so I'm always ultimately grateful that regardless of that overwhelming sense, like, nobody's invested in me, nobody cares about me, and, you know, I just, like, sink into my depression and lie down in my bed at home. My mother tells me, go to school, like, I'm not going, leave me alone. But then you have that one teacher that's, you know, like, Tiff, I know this is pretty crappy, and I know you want this or that, but you got to deal with what it is, and you're going to go to college, and, you know, so I had a lot of that, too, so.
Yeah. You wanna? Well, what teacher was that?
I'm not gonna say that. Yeah, come on. You know, damn, you gonna make me name drop? I ain't name dropping. I'm
not saying the bad one. Well, we could say the bad one.
Oh, the good one. The good one is in my book, Miss Bogoslavsky.
Okay, she's there you go. I didn't mean the bad one.
Oh, okay.
Come on, we know who the bad one is. Come on. If you went to North Bergen, you knew.
No, I actually, speaking of North Bergen, a great North Bergen story is I never went to the graduation. In protest of this teacher that it had at the time, who was like this English teacher. And I remember her giving like this writing prompt, and I was like, does this woman know English? You know, and I was like a really terrible nerd, I'm not gonna lie. And back to the outrage part, you know, I was always that bitch. I was like, how could this woman have a job? What kind of writing prompt is this? And I remember going home and telling my mom, like, I am not doing this, blah, blah, blah. And they fought me about dropping the class because it was like an AP English class. And they told me, like, oh, you signed a contract and you have to stay in the class. I was like, sign a contract? I'm 17. I can't sign it. Let me
know. You're like, that's legal.
Like, that's illegal. Possible. Like, gotta hear, you know.
You were woke enough then. You're like,
right. Oh, yeah. I'm always fighting with somebody, by the way. It has, like, this is just an extension of me fighting everybody all the time. Like, this whole book and everything. Now I'm just fighting the United States of America. Yeah. But, yeah, it started in North Bergen.
You're working your way up. You know?
Working my way up.
We'll be at the UN one day.
Kind of already. But that's a whole nother story. Okay. So, I couldn't do it. By the time, I think I spent 2 years in North Bergen High School. I was like, I stopped going for a while. You know, and they were like,
you did. Oh.
How does this kid who has these great grades, who, you know, her teachers love her, this, that, the other, like, why doesn't she want to come here? And it's like, do you want me to answer why? It's like, because y'all are doing shit. That's why, you know? And I was never afraid to say it. And I really was never afraid to, like, stand for myself. And ultimately, you know, stand for all those students who may not have been aware of how they were being shortchanged, right? Because they're from that environment. They don't have anything to compare it to. Mm-hmm. They just know that. And, you know, for me, I had so much to compare it to that I couldn't settle my outrage. I just couldn't. So I just stopped going for a while. I ain't doing this. And then eventually they let me drop the class. And, you know, some of the smarter folks that are really supportive kind of stood up for me and told me, look, listen, just do what you got to do. Get the hell out of here. And that's literally how I ended my relationship with North Bergen High School.
So for all those North Bergen High School students listening, just do your thing and get out of there.
I mean, whoever was in class with me would so distinctly remember this because I would be like, I'm not coming in this class. And I'll like protest and like stand outside. And that's the worst.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's students like that today.
I'm sure they're worse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You think so?
I know so. I know that the next generation, we may think that they're pansies because they can't cross the street to go get bread, but they use their voices.
Oh, they can organize a group. They text can organize chat today,
the whole. They can organize the heck out of themselves, and they're really not afraid to stand for themselves. And you know, it's a big narrative happening right now with I think they call them Gen Z, where you know even millennials realized that we were willing to put up with a shit ton of stuff from our employers. Mm-hmm. That they are not willing to put up with.
Or just in general from culture, I think. Like, we look back at 90s sitcoms, and we're like, can you believe we said that? Or they said that? So we did accept a lot of things.
We accepted a lot of really.
And I think it happens every generation, obviously. And I think it's important for us to look at those things and say, one, we understand it's not right then. We understand it's not right now, but back then, that was a cultural thing. So, like, this cancel thing of going back 20 years and trying to cancel for something that was culturally appropriate at the moment is the wrong way to go about it.
But to recognize
that no, it is wrong, so don't do that moving forward.
Right. And you know, that's, I think honestly, like, the beauty of the work and the attitude of the next generation is what is inspiring for me, even, you know, as a part of this. I mean, I ain't that old yet. You know, it's not like the ship done sailed on me or nothing.
But
we getting up there. My back hurt in the morning.
They talk about LeBron James getting old. You're like, wait, he's my age. What are you talking about?
Yeah, when your knees start shaking a little, you know, when you land the wrong way, you know. Yeah. So But ultimately, I'm really hopeful just from seeing how committed they are to, you know, standing for themselves and all, ultimately also standing for what's right, even when it has nothing to do with who they are. You know, there's a ton of organizing. There's a ton of young folks that are just doing amazing things. So that's like the glimmer of hope, even for us lazy millennials.
Yes.
Lord.
You know, all we want to do is watch MTV. Or is that Gen...
That doesn't exist. you mean like the teen mom shows? Yeah. Lord.
Or G's to Gents, that one of my favorite shows.
I don't even know what that is. I live under a rock.
No, all right. That's also showing my age. I think that was about 10 years ago as well.
Oh, no. You're dating yourself.
Yeah.
You're ancient.
I know. But you know what? I'd love to leave off with kind of what you envision. I know the book just came out, so let's not talk about next steps. We're actually in it right now. What do you envision for this book, and where do you see it moving, or where do you see your career? What opportunities this book brings? What do you envision through this book?
I'm going to answer the first part because I'm always on to the next thing. Okay. You know, in all honesty, in my head, I'm already on to the next book. I've actually submitted another proposal to my publisher, and I'm hoping that they give me the green light to move forward with that next project, because I really hope that this book could really be a springboard for me to get involved with all of the pressing issues of the time, you know. And I've already said it a million and one times about food security and about sustainability and about renewables. And these are all canceling student loan debt. Cancel the debt.
Please cancel it, please.
Cancel. Please. Cancel the debt. These are all...
Make my life so much easier.
I know, right? These are all the essentials of the moment. So for me, this book is so important in that it will give people a real reckoning with the United States of America and all that we've been sold, like the narratives around meritocracy and individualism and all of that. Like, I just want to disrupt the heck out of all of those things, because the true story is one of collectivism. It's one of group effort, is one of allies. Without those things, there's no way that we're going to meet this moment that is literally like a tsunami. You know, this thing is like a tsunami. And the more people awaken to the truth of what it means to be successful in America, even if we're going to deal with success, we could deal with success or just survival, what it takes to survive the United States of America, it's only going to become more increasingly difficult with time. And that's something that everybody needs to accept and everybody needs to be prepared for. So for me, I just hope that this book is like my opportunity to advocate as much for people, you know, who look like me, people who are from oppressed communities, minorities, to have any kind of say in what the future of this country will be and the future of the world. Ultimately, like, this is a global conversation, and we understand that so much more now with the war happening in Ukraine, watching how just a sanction on one country can make your gas, your oil and gas go to like unfathomable heights, where it's like it surpassed the highest it's ever been in the United States history, not adjusting for inflation. They didn't even adjust for inflation. So it's worse than what is being reported. That's a fact. So with all of that said, the only way forward is by like us uniting. And that's my hope for this book. It just disrupt all the individualism, meritocracy crap, and we get together and we say, we doing this, we coming for y'all.